Blog Talk Radio.
Peace be on our noble and honorable listening audience. You have listened once again to another edition of Religion Means Alive. A lot has happened, and a lot is happening on Religion Means Alive. We have with us today Brother Alfred Muhammad, a future student at Morehouse University. And he's going to pose questions to me. We're going to discuss issues. Obviously, the passing of Muhammad Ali. I guess he'll be asking me, did I know Muhammad Ali? My son accused me of being Forrest Gump. And I will explain whether I'm guilty of those charges or not. So if you, with those words, first of all, I'd like to announce sympathy to the Muhammad Ali family, particularly to his brother, Rudolph, and he used to be known as Rudolph. I knew him as Brother Rudolph, also known as Brother Rahman, and to his family, and I know his ex-wife quite well, and his daughter, Mariam. She's been a guest on our program. So with those words, I'm going to turn it over to Alfred Y. Muhammad, who will ask questions, and then you can join the conversation at 805-727-7013. 805-727-7013. We're going to talk about Muhammad Ali. We're going to talk about the election. We got a lot to talk about. And last week, Brother Earl Sadiq asked me mostly questions about myself. And while I don't mind answering questions about myself, it may give you some illumination. I prefer to answer questions about issues that we face. My son would tell you I'm not a very personable conversationalist. I don't really like to talk about me. I like to talk about the issues of the time. And I'm not one of the issues of the time. In that I'm a participant observer in the greatest century in the history of man and in the greatest movement in the history of man, that is the community of Imam W.D. Muhammad, the most important movement since Prophet Muhammad himself. And with those words, I'm going to now turn it to Brother Alfred Y. Muhammad, who will ask questions of me.
Right. Peace be on the honorable listening audience. My name is Alfred Muhammad II. I'll be conducting the interview today here on Religion Means Alive. And this will be my third interview with the Imam, and people have often told me that I've done a good job with the interview process. I like to interview people. I like to also, even just when I'm not even doing a show, I like to talk to my father and ask some questions, because I always joke with him and say that my father is a real-life Forrest Gump, and in a way he is. He's seen many movements. He's seen the Civil Rights Movement. He's been around long enough to see the Civil Rights Movement. He's seen He's been a part of the Nation of Islam movement, the peace movement. He's been a part of many movements. And I think people often make fun of me because, you know, I have an older father, but I think having an older father is actually a strength more than it is an actual weakness, because you have somebody who could tell you a number of things, a number of perspectives, and it's also made me a bit of a history buff, you know, as well, and it's made me more engaged with the world around me. I think more mature than my peers and my counterparts, and I think it's made me a lot smarter having older parents. And before I just get in the interview, I just want to touch on the fact that CNN has been running for the past 3 years these shows called it's the 60s, the 70s, and now it's the 80s. And in each decade, I can ask my dad a question. I can ask my father a question about each decade. And I can say, did you remember this in the 60s? Did you remember that in the 70s? Did you remember this in the 80s? And on each occasion, my father can say, yeah, I remember that. Through and through, I remember that. And that's something that not every parent can do, because most parents are in their 40s. But some of these parents, they were born in 75, born in 76. So they don't remember any of that. The only thing they remember is probably, you know, the 90s or the 80s or whenever it is they were born. So my dad has been, you know, so they have a threshold as to what they can tell their kids they remember. But my dad really, really has no true boundary, because he has parents who are older as well. So he grew up with older parents. So my dad definitely knows a lot about history, and it's always interesting to get his perspective. So interviewing him is really no, it's really not particularly hard. And even when I come up with the questions, that's not hard either. And I can always ad-lib and ask questions from there. So I'm going to start off with, we're going to save Muhammad Ali for last. And we're going to start off with asking Imam a question on this year's election. If anybody knows me, knows I like politics. I like to follow politics now more than even sports. And I'm going to ask my dad about this election year. This is 2016. It's an election year. And with an election year coming up, that means that a president is outgoing. And so with that being said, what do you think President Obama's legacy is leaving office with all his accomplishments? He might have some negatives, might have some positives. What do you think President Obama's legacy is leaving office in 2016?
I would say that President Barack Hussein Obama is the greatest president America has ever known. Now, one would ask the question, how, Brother Imam, can you make that statement? Well, to perform a more perfected union. America First was born, as Condoleezza Rice, Secretary Condoleezza Rice says, Dr. Condoleezza Rice, America was born with a birth defect. Philip Roth, the novelist, called white supremacy the human stain. And for the first time in America's history, she redeemed herself by electing President Obama and making it truly a universal, not a particularized country. That's one. That's the context. Now let's talk about the man or the mind that came into America. Here's a man that came from both African and European background. Essentially, was raised in a multicultural society. That is, in Indonesia, in Hawaii, and then adopted the African-American life and culture in Chicago, Illinois, and at Columbia University and studied. This is the first president in American history who had that kind of wide breadth and depth. So that makes him a man for the people. That's number two. That's the man. Now let's get to the mind. The mind is a universal mind. And I know for a fact that President Obama had to have come through the cauldron or the conundrum, as it were, of American life and heavily had to be influenced by Imam Waruddin Muhammad. Why I say that? Because before Imam Waruddin Muhammad, no African-American could even conceptualize being the president of the United States. So now we have answered context, and we have answered that question. Now let's get to certain operational questions as a president. I have studied every president extensively because at one time I aspired to be the president of the United States of America. So I had a father, Joseph Booker, who I'm sure had political aspirations. So I said I was baptized in politics, starting with President Eisenhower. I was joking when I was a child and said, why did Stevenson kill the dog? Because the dog said, I. Well, that's the kind of context which I grew up with, talking to Joseph Booker, the son of a slave, and observing politics. So every president I've observed, and I would say this about President Obama. First major accomplishment was saving America from the brink of economic collapse. Number two, the health care bill. And number three, giving America a true American spirit. America has not had a true American spirit. America has had a spirit of white supremacy until it redeemed itself from the human stain. The problem is, the African-American has not been prepared for freedom, so we don't really know how to appreciate and contextualize the president. The American people have not been prepared to see an African-American president. So the president has had some great challenges. He's handled it with grace. As President, Vice President Joseph Biden said, Osama bin Laden is dead and General Motors has been resurrected. Those are great things. It used to be said, General Motors goes, so goes the country. So we see just those two major achievements. On the military front, one of the greatest enemies America's ever known was killed on President Barack Hussein Obama's watch. Number two, General Motors. As General Motors goes, so goes the United States. What's good for General Motors, good for the United States. General Motors has been resurrected.
Okay. So, just to actually elaborate more, because the question was, I believe, answered pretty well, but we still got to talk about, what do you think the president's legacy, what do you think he wants his legacy to be coming out of office? What do you think, particularly, he wants the United States to follow after he comes out of office? What do you think he wants to set the tone coming out of office
as? Well, I think he wanted to show America is first to be a unified country, that America has lived up to its ideals. You know, that it's not a black-white society. It's a universal society. That's a major accomplishment. America has never accomplished that before. I think he also said that America should have a repentant spirit. Now, this is implicit. Most people don't like that. When you go and visit Cuba, Vietnam, overtures to Iran, he's taking America out of the enemy. America's always been the big bad policeman. It's called Pax Americana. That's been the foreign policy. President Obama wisely has and gradually brought America back from the brink of that. And I think that's the continuous legacy. It might be, well, speak softly and curl a big stick, as Harry Truman said. But I think America's been the policeman of the world. President Obama has prepared America and the world to see America as a part of a multilateral approach to foreign policy and defense policy. And economically speaking, that's the only way we can survive. The president didn't get an opportunity to really develop a real economic program. He was advised against it, and I don't think the will of this country was for it.
All right. That was answered pretty well. So continuing our topic on the election year and 2016, tell me, what do you think about this electorate regarding the American people? Tell me, how do you feel about the emotions that the American people are feeling, why they feel this way, why they are acting this way? Tell us about the emotional feel of the electorate right now in this country.
I was having lunch some time ago with a very prominent, a leading Christian who had just left, a right-wing Christian, top-like right-wing Christian, who really is not right-wing at all, but actually is a practical businessman who said we would gin the base up. And he ended up selling to this other Caucasian Christian. He's going to vote for President Obama. This was in the 2008 and the 2012 election. So I think what has happened is, when you let animals out of the cage, they can become quite dangerous. I'm not calling the right-wing people animals, but I'm saying that base instinct. And they have a reason to be angry. They have a real reason to be angry. I'm from Lynchburg, Virginia, as you know, Alfred. And Lynchburg used to be a city of industry, manufacturing new paper, Meade Corporation, the foundry, manufacturing iron products, steel. There was jobs. African American come out of school, anybody come out of school. After you were 18 years old, you could go to a job. You could get a job. That's not the case today. And that's not the case all over America. There are only three places you can get a job at today: schools, shopping centers, correctional facilities, and hospitals. That's it. Our society can't prosper like that. When your men can't work, and the men go lead the society. That's why we have such an uneven, unyoked society, as it were. So, with that being in mind, I understand the anger. What we have with Mr. Senator Sanders is a channeling of anger. What we have with Mr. Trump is the champ. And we have the people of Rio.
But without going too in depth about the candidates yet, because we're going to touch on the candidates. Just the electorate. What, summarize in one word just what this electorate is feeling right now.
Just in one word right now.
This electorate is damn angry and can't take it anymore, and that's what these candidates are channeling.
Gotcha. So anger is pretty much what the electorate is feeling. So do you believe that many of the candidates are feeding off of this anger? And if so, how are they doing it? Which way are they channeling it? What are they saying? What are some of the words that they're using in order to get votes? And pretty much, can you tell us why we are here and how we got to these candidates? You told us about Jen and Base Up on the right, but what's also going on the left? Because America has a two-pronged system.
Well, the left is ginning up the base, too. I mean, the left is saying, look, let's overthrow the government. They aren't saying it directly, but they are advocating socialistic programs. They're advocating more government. They're advocating more massive spending. I mean, they know that there's no will for that in this country. They know that. That's irresponsible.
There seems to be a major will for it in this country.
This country is very divided. About 40% people in this country, 40% of people in this country are on the left. 40%, maybe 40% don't give a damn one way or another what happens. A two opted out. And then you have another percentage of people who just a little bit thinking. We're in a very, very dangerous time in American history. Perhaps the most dangerous time. But I would say to those who study history, there are two important books by a great historian called Richard Hofstadter. One of them is Anti-Intellectualism in American Life and Pernod Styles in American Life. Both of those books are very telling. What we're rendering now is a Pernod style in American life, and what we also is an anti-intellectualism. None of the candidates are really talking about the real core issue. Now, Mr. Sanders, I'm not going to talk about the candidates, but I mean there is a social gridlock. I don't want to go into it. You can. I don't want to get ahead of the question.
No, I told you not to go into it, but you can go into the candidates now.
Well, okay, Senator Sanders has been a man of the left, and I was once a man of the left. My first introduction to social life, I was a leftist. I've come away from those views. So Senator Sanders is still on the barricades. He's still ready for the demonstration, ready for the revolution. I agree with some of the things he says. I don't see what the need for socialism. I really don't. But that's another political decision. I don't want to get into the politics. But I think that none of these candidates, including Secretary Clinton, has a clue as to what this country needs. I think this country will continuously drift until people like you and others. Not just youth. I don't believe it's going to be youth. I don't believe what Eddie Gloud said, democracy in black. No, I don't believe that. I don't think we've reached that yet. But I think there has to be a stern message for America and what James Baldwin called a stern warning.
Why do you believe this country has gotten so partisan over the years? Because back in the day, in the 60s, when people were, you know, it was civil unrest in this country, it still wasn't as partisan as, you know, as it is now. Nowadays, you see Congress is in a perpetual gridlock. They can't get anything done. You know, nobody wants to really do anything. And you see a more divisive, a more divided country, like you said before. But why is that so? Why are people so... You said they're angry, but why is it so divided? Why can't we get anything done? Why can't we find a common ground within this country?
Because this country has gone away from any kind of civil discourse. It started with my generation. Don't respect anybody over 30. The left versus the right. President Nixon almost wrecked the economy, the country. And not so much the economy, I mean, he wrecked it. the country was desegregated. There's tremendous fear on the part of Caucasians, Americans, about losing that place and that standing. And I don't think African Americans have dealt with it correctly. I don't think we have allayed those fears. I think we have engaged in a whole bunch of narcissistic ideas, and our street people have become extraordinarily nihilistic. And we are a burden upon society. I mean, it's just a fact. We don't want to deal with that. You know, I've been teaching for the past month on mass incineration to mass incarceration. And now we're advocating mass resurrection. What I mean by that? 43 shootings over the weekend in Chicago alone, city of the President of the United States. What's wrong with us? Where's Jesse Jackson? Where's Louis Farrakhan? I don't have a voice, but I've been speaking out for the last 6 years on the carnage that's taking place in the streets of America, namely when you get near Martin Luther King Boulevard, look out and call an ambulance.
All right, so now that we've addressed the electorate, we're going to bring it, see, we segued into that pretty perfectly, I believe, is because what do you think, I've asked this before in other interviews, what do you think the current state of the African American is right now? Do you think it's going backwards? Do you think it's going forward? Tell us, do you think it's too progressive? Do you think it's too conservative? What do you think the current state of African Americans is right now in this country?
Well, I think that Kendrick Lamar put it better than I could ever put it. We're pimping a butterfly. A butterfly has been a worm that's been transformed into the butterfly. We don't have anything. Basically, what has happened is our leaders have been pimping us. They're just telling good, feel-good slogans. It's the government. It's there. We need jobs. No, we don't need a job. We need a new mind. We need a new will. We need a new spirit. We need a plan. You know, why don't we tell our people what President Obama told us at the Howard Commission? You were there. Let's acknowledge, first of all, that we have won, that we have achieved victory. Let's acknowledge that we have billionaires among us. Let's tell a young man on the street that's riding his scooter that got his pants sagging that there is a better way. Huh? That's pumping on a what?
On a dime bag of weed.
On a dime bag of weed. And what are those things he's smoking? The blunt, the spliff, all these black and mild, whatever. Spliffs, all these crazy things. This started with my generation. Huh? Drop out, turn on, tune in, turn out, all this stuff. This is all a part of my generation. So I asked the young people to forgive me. I was a part of that revolution. I led that turning people on. We were happy to turn people on the pot. Oh, man, I just turned them on. It was like almost a religion. Look at him. He's all square. He's uptight. Give him a joint. So instead of people going to school, we smoke weed. Free love, free sex. All of this has to be walked back. I am guilty of that. I am sorry that I was a participant, observer, an active participant, observer in the destruction of America. Now, that's number one. I also was part of a movement called the Lost Foundation of Islam that taught there was no life after death. Imagine a young Negro, black, colored, African American, whatever you want to call it. It in and of itself tells us we have an identity crisis. That is angry and maybe prepared to go out in the streets and shoot somebody. Huh? Maybe prepared to go out in the street and shoot somebody. Now that he doesn't believe that there is any life after death, there's no consequences. So we have to be able to understand. Excuse me. We have to understand. We have to understand that the movement of the Lost Foundation of Islam, all the good we're standing, taken out of the fear of God, that there's a consequence to our action. I feel sorry for young men today that don't realize that there's a consequence. That's what the Buddhists call karma. that you go out here and shoot somebody, before you get out of here, you're going to get punished. You're going to suffer that. The average young man doesn't realize that. We've given them a religion of nihilism, a religion of empty promises, that there's no results, that you can write a blank check, and that there's no return on that check. Well, that's not the case. And I said, as a religious person, and as a person that believed, and I had a brother who was a criminal who said before he got out of here, he said, look, I'm sorry. I was witness him dying. He said he was very sorry for all the things he did because he saw that death angel. So I wish people could hear my brother as he pleaded with young people not to go down the road he's going down. He knew it was over, but he knew he had to meet his maker. And that's what our young people need to understand, too. This is not the end. So God ain't going to ask you, well, I didn't get no job, so I stuck the old lady up. God ain't going to ask you that question. You know, I didn't go to school. I didn't do nothing because they wouldn't let me. All right. Those excuses are gone.
So are you saying there's a lack of God within this current generation? Not really a lack of God, but a lack of consequences and repercussions that is within my generation, really, particularly.
Well, my generation started.
Yeah.
It has gone to the 10th power with your generation. And nobody has been honest and sincere enough to go and walk this stuff back. Well, what we do is we do what Mr. Farrakhan does, blame the society. We do what Donald Trump is doing, make America great again. All these slogans, Bernie Sanders, you know, the rich, the plutocrat. All of that is just blaming others for the lack of social responsibility. This is not to go into policy, because I would love to discuss policy. And I think that none of these candidates, including Ms. Clinton, Secretary Clinton, has a clue. They are clueless as how to reindustrialize the society, how to bring the society back to some moral sense. They're clueless. They're just saying slogans and making all kinds of statements and following all kinds of focus groups. The Clintons are the biggest focus group of all. None of them have any courage. Mr. Trump is just winging it. He's just a salesman. Bernie Sanders is just a rabble rouser. And they just all just going through that kind of strategy. But they don't have any strategy to bring anybody together.
Do you think that, now that we're back on the topic of Donald Trump, do you think that Donald Trump ultimately is just a backlash to the president and just really seeing that almost, I wouldn't say jealousy, but a gag reflex is the better term that white America is having to the minorities and other people who are rising throughout this country? Do you think it's a gag reflex, a backlash, President Obama and the winning mentality taking place within?
First of all, let me correct you by telling you what Donald Muhammad said about political discourse. I don't call him Donald Trump. I call him Mr. Trump. He's president of the Trump Organization. So that's number one. I call him that. I call Senator Sanders. We have to get a civil discourse. The man has a title. He's never been elected to any office, as far as I know. He is the head man in charge of the Trump Organization, although he's been bankrupt several times. I don't hold that against him because I've been a bankrupt preparer. So let's grant him that. But let's just call him for what he is, Mr. Trump. Mr. Trump is one of the world's greatest salesmen. And he's an Elmer Gantry type, basically a huckster. And he's a panic merchant. Yes, he knows that the Caucasian is angry. So he's channeling that anger for popularity. This guy, for crying out loud, been on The Apprentice. He's a huckster. These types come along. Only this time he's selling fear. And yes, it's a reaction. The Caucasian is terrified, particularly Caucasian men. They're terrified. They're losing jobs. They don't know what's causing it. President Trump is not going to offer any real solutions. I mean, he has no real proposals. I mean, it sounds good. I know down in Lynchburg there's no jobs down. I understand the Caucasian Senate. It looks like the niggas got everything. That's his thing. It looks like we get affirmative action. I think the thing that really would ameliorate and take the legs off from Trump, if African Americans would stand up and thy soul and take responsibility for their own lives. We got $2.1 trillion. Why don't we make Howard University, this university, Meharry Medical College, let's produce these institutions, Morehouse. Let's make them world-class universities that they are the envy of the world. Yes. Take on more responsibility. Let's go out into the public square and demand that African Americans take on more responsibility. You know, that would change the whole discourse, period. Then we would be on a platform to talk about what we think is the real solution to American problems. And I tell you what the real solution to American problems. Stop borrowing so much damn money. Cut back on some of the spending that they have. But if we take on more responsibility, we would have a platform in which to do that.
So you're saying that right now, African Americans, what we have gotten into and what we have gotten into is a state of almost complaining, where we believe that the government is wrong and the government is doing everything to us, which, and to a certain extent, is fair. Who do you think is causing this message to happen, causing this message to fester within our society? Who do you think is causing this message? Is it our leaders? Is it the people? Is it just a natural synthesis that is going on within the people? What is going on? What is causing this message of government, of hating the government and other messages with the same, you know, caliber?
It's the hidden forces of the culture. This is a 60-year process that's taken place. So African Americans are angry. African Americans never were told by Dr. King and his people that we had achieved a victory. So we're still fighting a battle that's over. We don't have to worry about. You can go to any store anywhere in the United States and buy anything. You can go to any college that will admit you. You can compete with others for jobs. But we don't know the nature of America. America is, when you go to a law firm, you're going to hire somebody to look like you. So other people practice and discriminate. I know this is very painful for African Americans. If you go to somebody else who owns a cleaners and tell them they got a family-owned business to hire, if I'm in the Booker Muhammad clan and you ask a Booker that's qualified and can work in my store, I'm going to hire Booker or Muhammad. Booker is the plantation which I came from. Muhammad is the family which I belong to. I hope all my family will eventually become Muhammad and lead a plantation. That's another problem for us. Still being owned by the white man. Still feeling that he is responsible for our lives. Do you know we could create 2 million jobs overnight? If the preachers in our neighborhood decided to preach for the next year on taking back our cleaners, and then we can keep Ray Ray from sticking us up, keep people from stealing in our stores. I was traveling through the South recently, and I thought about, we don't even have one chicken chain, and we cook the best fried chicken. Not efficient. Look how many jobs could be created. Look at how many farmland we still own. The solution to our problem is within our hands. And because we're not availing ourselves of that, and we're not being told that we can win, again, there are about 3 or 4 African-American billionaires. Just read about one, he's in software, billionaire. We can't deny that. We can't deny that we're even in the United States Senate, 2 of us, statewide office. We can't deny that. So I think that our people have been sold a pessimistic picture of where we are in America. I'm not selling us a rosy picture. I know it is. I know some of the difficulties that we're going through. But God knows, coming from Lynchburg, Virginia in 1947, when I couldn't even go into a hospital, couldn't go into a physician's office and sit in his waiting room. And most of the physicians in Lynchburg wouldn't even treat me. And my own physician couldn't even come to the hospital except as a visitor. I know we have made progress.
Tell us what was so interesting about the Nation of Islam and what made you sort of make this progression from leftist, fight the power kind of thinking mentality, which isn't wrong in itself. It's not a wrong way to think. It might need to be modified according to your thinking. But what do you think, what was so intriguing about the Nation of Islam that drew you in and made you want to start thinking almost in a different way, seeing the United States in a different light, and the mentality that the Nation of Islam has?
The Nation of Islam attracted Muhammad Ali, Malcolm, well-known people, many others, including myself, because his message of self-responsibility was a compelling message. It told me that I was just as good, if not better than others, because of time and circumstances. And it told me that I could be responsible for my own life. That was a striking message. And it took me out of the heaven after I die and the sweet by and by. You know, I believe I could go to the store and buy my own milk. I could go to the aviary and get my own honey. I was looking for it after I die. I want it now. And so it took me out of a sky religion of seeking the next life. But I felt that the Nation of Islam didn't take me out of focusing on the next life. It put the focus on this life. And when Imam Muhammad came and integrated this life and the future life with me, buddy, old buddy, I was ready to sail through all the seas and all the storms and all the lightning and was prepared to go to the shore of victory.
All right, so now that we've touched on the Nation of Islam and now that we're on the subject of the Nation of Islam, talk about Muhammad Ali and why do you think the American people took to him so much? And even though he criticized the United States on topics such as the Vietnam War, the treatment of African Americans, and pretty much almost went the opposite route. He went from, at one point in his career, went from an American hero to a complete despot in the eyes of white America. Tell us what do you believe the Nation of Islam did to make a man completely change his orientation and see the world in a different light? I mean, we know you did, but what would make a boxer who's already a hero, he's already loved by white America, why would he, you know, change his outlook when he's already doing prosperous, doing well? So what made him want to do that?
Well, I don't think they were doing prosperous. I mean, we saw Joe Louis walk around as a punch drunk person, broke, out of doors, basically, and other athletes who just has been. They enjoyed glory, generally was ripped off. And what's the difference between Ali, who is a 74-year-old man that was a hero of the world? He saw something big, deeper than that. And I happen to, you perhaps don't know, I never shared it with you. I knew Muhammad Ali personally. I first met him on the campus of the University of Wisconsin at Madison. We had invited him as a student to speak. He was a funny, jovial guy. I didn't take him very seriously because he was carrying the message of the Honorable Muhammad. Remember, he was a minister of the Honorable Muhammad. And I was drawn to the Honorable Muhammad. I was inactive in the Nation of Islam. I later got to know him by spending 30 days at his training camp in Deer Lake, Pennsylvania with him. And that's where I got to know him. It's a very quiet. In fact, I got the invitation to come to his training camp, and I'm going to explain more about the appeal. It's that I was walking down 7th Avenue by the Americana Hotel, and he said, "Assalamu alaikum." And I said, "Well, alaikum assalam." He asked me how I was up doing. Did I have any money in my pocket? He knew I was a regular FOI, and generally we didn't have any money because we were selling papers. And I said, "Yes, I did." I lied to him. I didn't. I just had the general policy. I wouldn't ask officials or stars for money. I thought it was bad to do that, bad taste. So he invited me to come to his training camp. He had lost the fight, and he wanted to be around Muslim brothers. So I spent time with him, got to talk with him, knew his talk with his. I was already a friend of his brother. At that time, was known as Rudolph, a Rahman. I knew him. I knew his father-in-law, Lieutenant Raymond, and I knew Belinda, which was his wife. Didn't know her well because we didn't know them. Well, now, to answer your question about the appeal, much of the sports world is similar to the entertainment world. It is the entertainment world. Sport and play. Fun, triviality. I think Ali had something deeper in his soul, and he recognized that. And Minister Captain Sam, which was the FOI captain in Miami, appealed to him, appealed to his nature, because he could accept the criticism that the Honorable Elijah Muhammad was leveling at Caucasian or, quote, unquote, white society. He, the Honorable Elijah Muhammad, had described our life in America as slavery, suffering, and death. So Ali wanted something more, but when I studied Muhammad Ali's father, Cassius Clay I, Cassius Clay was an exceptional person. His mother was a very quiet, very pious lady, so the Nation of Islam message appealed to him. Just like it appealed to me. I was a good Christian boy from a good Christian mama. And Cassius Clay was sort of a worldly man, but I think he was a man of race pride. So when you combine piety and race pride together in a package, the message of the Honorable Elijah Muhammad appealed to him. And then the brotherhood. Most sports figures are controlled by criminal enterprises. I don't want to name any ethnic groups. But they're controlled by those people. And they're generally broke after they've finished their career. They're punch drunk and broke. I guess Ali didn't want that. And the Nation of Islam became a family. And I want to also add, as the New York Times pointed out, Muhammad Ali didn't give money to the Nation of Islam. The Nation of Islam gave money to him. Some people thought he was a cash cow for the Nation of Islam. He was not a cash cow for the Nation of Islam. I know for a fact that people gave him money. You know, Abdullah Muhammad gave him money. So, a lot of myths out about Muhammad Ali. He was and is a great man. Why I say is, because he's in the spirit and soul of many Americans. And I think America likes a winner. That's why they put out the Rocky myth. America likes a winner. Here's a man that was knocked down. He was vociferous. And his defense of his personality and ego. America like a good ego. He's a great story. Got knocked down, won. See, America doesn't like losers. And even after getting knocked out of the sports ring, he came back and got his championship. But he remained a human being. And I'm telling you something. I would say this, and you know me. I don't have 0.1%, maybe 100% of notoriety that Muhammad Ali is. But people don't know, when you go out to greet people, you know, I come back sometime from greeting people, and I'm so tired, I'm knocked out for the next day. Well, Muhammad Ali, I've been around him, seen him receive thousands of guests. And he's normal, decent human being. I think also the fact about Muhammad Ali is that he, as Bob Arum, Attorney Bob Arum, former U.S. attorney, whose job was to prosecute people for tax evasion, and said, I think he helped prosecute Joe Louis and other boxers. He said when he saw how much money the boxers made, he left, practiced law, and got in and became a boxing promoter. And he's one of the only honest people that have come in contact with Muhammad Ali, and a lot of them, that pointed out that it was the Honorable Elijah Muhammad and Imam Waruddin Muhammad that transformed Muhammad Ali. Muhammad Ali would have been just like any of the rest of us 50 years ago, teaching that America is doomed, the white man is the devil, Christians is slavery, suffering, and death. That was our mantra. But he met a word from his Lord through Imam Waruddin Muhammad, the son of the Ahmadiyya Muhammad, that transformed him into a universal man and expanded his heart where his heart could have the place, a repository for all human beings, but never forget your own people. That's the great message of Muhammad Ali. And as a result of that fact,
he transcended sports.
Yeah, he always transcended sports. The nation missed on being transcended sports. Yeah, he was the only athlete. There were other athletes that came who were very sympathetic, but they couldn't break. There were entertainers that couldn't break. They're martyrs. They came to our meetings. Jim Brown was one of them. I remember telling Jim Brown one time, I said, man, I'm really proud of what you're doing. And he stopped me. He said, brother, I learned that from Temple number 23 in Buffalo. And I've had other great people to say the same thing. James Brown was one of them said that. So the Temple of Islam was a center of transformation for African Americans, period. And millions had gone through there and had their mind transformed, whether they decided to join or not. Ali was one of the most noted ones.
Do you believe that Muhammad Ali, as of right now, sets the standard for the way that right now, do you think he sets the standard of the way that an African-American athlete should act, the way he should voice his opinion? Do you believe he broke the chains that sort of the African-American athlete had on himself back in the 60s and the 70s? Do you believe that he did that with his charisma?
Well, I don't think most people could live up to Muhammad Ali. Muhammad Ali was super exceptional. I met other athletes. I just met a very famous baseball player who will remain anonymous. I think that what happened with Ali, he was exceptional. He was super exceptional. I wouldn't hold everybody to that kind of standard. But I do think that they have to recognize that they are representing that race, that they have come from great struggle, and that they should be great respectful. But I think also the environment that they have come in, most of them have not come into the environment that Muhammad Ali came into, that Minister Malcolm came into. And that was an environment of a word environment that transformed them, that took them off the plantation life of dependency upon Caucasians. And that was a rejection or counter-rejection of Caucasians' life and even the Caucasian religion. And I think all African Americans should study Muhammad Ali to see how he was transformed. And I would urge every African American and other people who are scholarly in their interest to see what happened to Muhammad Ali is to study Message to the Black Man by the Honorable Elijah Muhammad. The Nation of Islam was a myth, but myths are very, very powerful in the life of human beings. And when we study those myths demythologize another myth, which is the myth of white supremacy. And white supremacy has been a great myth, but the Nation of Islam came and smashed that myth, and no longer were white people considered invisible in gods. And then we came on an equal footing with Caucasians. And Ali, that's why he's being honored in his hometown. That's why even the president of Turkey is coming. That's why the president of the mosques and all the USCMO organizations have been invited, because he's a global phenomenon. President William Jefferson Clinton has been asked to speak at his memorial service. This is not the religious service. So this man is a global phenomenon, the biggest global phenomenon I have known in the history of man.
In a couple words, can you talk about what Imam Muhammad did for Muhammad Ali? I mean, he wasn't particularly around the Imam's movement toward the latter half of it. But just talk about what Muhammad Ali might have picked up just by osmosis with the Imam's message.
No, Muhammad Ali didn't pick it up. I suppose he was directly influenced by Imam Muhammad. He was just like the other 2 million of us, a million and a half that joined, and a million that was already. We were all transformed by Imam W.D. Muhammad. It was well known in the Nation of Islam. If you see the Savior's Day address from 1975, you'll see Muhammad Ali speaking at Imam Muhammad's inaugural address. And he was influenced. We were all influenced that Imam Muhammad was the leader. And there was no question that when Imam Muhammad took over, he was not talking from the lessons. He was not talking from the Bible. He was not talking from the message to the black man. He was talking from the Quran. And he opened his address with a reading from the Quran saying the dead must rise. So what he was really saying to us, we were in the Nation of Islam, we were dead. We thought we were resurrected, but we were dead too. We were dead to our humanity. We were dead to our social role. We were dead to the role that God had ordained for us. And when Allah blessed Muhammad Ali to accept that, he was a transformed person. He, in the later years, because of health issues, didn't come around, but he was at the last 2006 convention. He would come to conventions, sit on the stage to allow people to know that his leader and teacher was Imam Waqif Muhammad. There were some people that tried to get between the two of them, but there was a great love on the part of him. Well, for two reasons. One, he recognized Imam Muhammad as his teacher. Number two, they both were boxers. So Imam Muhammad used to go to the gym and spar with Muhammad Ali. They loved each other. Ali loved him, and Imam Muhammad loved Ali. And I'm told, just got correspondence from Imam Waqifuddin Muhammad II, that he will be there at the memorial service and been asked to participate by the family of Muhammad Ali. And he also recalled being very close to Muhammad Ali coming to 87th and Cornell to the house of Imam Muhammad and visiting. And so there's a closeness. There was no question. As Bob Aaron pointed out, again, I'm reiterating Bob Aaron, because Bob Aaron was an attorney for Muhammad Ali and a promoter, and he knew, as Don King knows, and all the rest of them know. I was there when Don King came to meet with Imam Muhammad. So these people know, and some choose not to tell it, but Muhammad Ali was a student of Imam Waqifuddin Muhammad. There's a recent book out about Malcolm Shabazz, Minister Malcolm Shabazz, that is, and Muhammad Ali. And the author says, well, there was no question that Muhammad Ali wouldn't have gone with Minister Farrakhan. He went with Imam Muhammad. And he just like all the rest of us, we decided, we knew that was the honor be like Muhammad's choice. It was just a logical conclusion. It was nothing unusual. The honor be like Muhammad told us. He said, 1957, this before Ali came in the Nation of Islam, February 26, 1957, at Tabernacle Baptist Church, to be exact. My son is to me as David is to Solomon. He would tear the temple down and rebuild it. And I've been there with Ali being on the stage. I was a really unknown person at the time. And now I'm like, Mom, pointed. He said, I'm so happy to have my son, Minister Wallace. He said, I'm not teaching you Islam. I'm setting you up for the next man. Sitting on the stage was Minister Wallace D. Muhammad, sitting on the stage with Muhammad Ali in an FOI uniform.
Was Minister Farrakhan there as well?
Minister Farrakhan was there. But it was always known by the members of the Nation of Islam that Minister Farrakhan was just a minister. He was called the charmer. But he was never expected to be a leader of anything.
Should we expect any new findings from, it's come to my understanding that you've been working in with a couple of, reporters and people about, on a biography of the Nation of Islam. Should we expect any new developments regarding information on Muhammad Ali and his relationship between Imam and, the Honorable Elijah Muhammad, et cetera? Should we expect anything in these upcoming books?
Well, I think you will expect it. There is a book by Ismail Reed. I think it's a true story of Muhammad Ali. The brother that you might know very well served as a source for it, Brother Ajib Bilal, Secretary Ajib Bilal, who was a secretary in the Nation of Islam. Secretary in the Nation of Islam was a high position, number three position in the Nation of Islam. The minister, the captain, secretary, the minister was responsible for teaching and being the overall leader of the temple. The captain was responsible for the organizational leadership of the temple, and the secretary was responsible for records and basically administration of the temple. So Secretary Ajib Bilal, in his capacity of assistant national secretary, informed Ismail Reed of a lot, and there's a lot of information in that book. There's another book that's already out called Muhammad Ali and Malcolm. There's another book is forthcoming by Jeff Diamond,
a Dr. Jeff Diamond just recently last week got his doctorate degree, which on the dissertation was Transnationalism, the Saudis, Imam W.D. Muhammad, and Authority. A very interesting dissertation that goes in depth into the Imam Muhammad's transformation of the Nation of Islam from a what some scholars would call a proto-Islamic movement into a full-fledged Islamic movement. Some scholars use the term a Sunni Muslim, but we don't use the term. Imam Muhammad never used that term. And Malcolm Shabazz never used that term, but Alex Haley, another man that I knew, I guess I'm another Paul Gump, Forrest Gump, but Alex Haley used that term and called it Orthodox Islam. But Imam Muhammad always called it New Islam. The Honorable Elijah Muhammad called the New Islam. Said one day you would get New Islam. Meaning we're not connected to the scholars. We respect them. We love them. We honor them. But they are for our time. They're not for our time. They can't tell me how to navigate America. They didn't have a democracy. They can't tell me how to deal with gender issues. They have a segregated society. They can't tell me how to become the president of the United States. They don't know anything about it. They don't know anything but the modern industrial world. They were not in it. So Almighty God, in his mercy, has raised up one of the ex-slaves who was born in an industrial society in Detroit, Michigan, outside of the mainstream of America, outside of Christianity, outside of Islam, outside of Judaic teachings, and has taught him, Imam Waruddin Muhammad, not just Quran, because a lot of people get that wrong, also has increased his soul, as W.E.B. Du Bois said, the souls of black folk, or the soul of this new people that is us.
Well, coming to a close, in short, can you just summarize, and I'll give you three words, Muhammad Ali's personality, and what you liked about him the most and what he brought to the forefront. So give me three words to help describe Ali, and then we're just going to close out the program.
Sincere. One of the nicest people you would meet on earth. You would not expect any celebrity. I've been around a lot of celebrities, and I'm telling you, being a celebrity or being known is not an easy thing. I've studied them. I'm known somewhat. It's very difficult to meet that challenge. Just a very decent human being, a man that revered God, revered family, and really I have to say this to people. He revered his association of us that were the brotherhood that came out of the Nation of Islam and those who followed the Honorable Elijah Muhammad and Imam Waruddin Muhammad. Revered it, just not respectful of it. But as I told you, the first time I met, well, second time I met him in person, just based on seeing him and talking, when he invited me to come and stay with him. And we stayed. And, you know, he was just a nice, decent human being.
Right. Well, with that being said, we're going to, any other remarks you want to talk about? We went from the election to the Nation of Islam to the state of African Americans, all the way to Muhammad Ali. Is there any other closing remarks you'd like to make? Or,
Well, I'd like to say to our noble audience that we are going to be back on the air more frequently. We are adjusting our schedule. And we appreciate your coming by to listen to Religion Means Alive. We expect to see you at the Ramadan session, the first, second, and third at Mosque Cares headquarters. I will be one of the presenters. Expect to see all you at the Mosque Cares convention. Some of you we might see in Louisville at Muhammad Ali's memorial service. Thank you. Peace be on our noble and honorable listeners. I'm going to turn you back in the hands of Alfred Y. Muhammad.
Hope we don't have to say anything else further. Peace be on our noble and honorable listening audience. You've listened once again to another edition of Religion Means Alive. We'll be on the air same time at 7 o'clock. We should be on the show more often. Thank you.